To make sure to thank Luskin Chef for sponsoring the program this morning. If you have a cell phone and you're able to silence it or at least put it on vibrate, that would be wonderful. Thank you. Last year, at the end of the year's CPD programs, there was a request to make the programs 90 minutes instead of 75 minutes. I'm not sure whether that had more to do with needing an even number of credits or to do with wanting me to speak longer. Thank you. I'd like to think so. So now the program is indeed 90 minutes, 8:45 to 10:15. Providing 1.5 professionalism credits. Just to make sure you know, we have 3 more programs planned for the current academic year. One is planned for Monday evening, January 25th at Shari Shamayim. It is Sell Yourself, the Rules of Ethical Advertising. That'll be at 7 p.m. on Monday, January 25th. The one after that is back here at the Bayit, Sunday, March 20th, 8:45 a.m., and that is the Ethics of Competing for Clients. And then Monday evening, May 30th, again back at Shari Shamayim, also at 7 p.m., Access to Justice, a Jewish Perspective on Pro Bono Work. So those are the ones planned for the year, each of them accredited for 1.5 professionalism credits. So this morning what I want to look at are a few practical questions. You see that I listed them there on the sheets under source number 1. The first one: David, an observant Jew, prepared a will in accordance with local law, distributing his property among his children equally and ignoring any considerations of Jewish law. His daughter Sarah declares she will refuse to accept any property bequeathed to her under the terms of this will. Under Jewish law, is Sarah correct? Is Sarah right for saying I wouldn't accept property under a general will? Second, moving forward in their, as their family situation develops, David wishes to appease Sarah. How might he prepare a legal will which conformed to Jewish law? And then third, David's son Sam has stopped observing Judaism, and David is concerned that his grandchildren will not be raised as Jews at all. David wishes to structure his will to exclude Sam, unless Sam would send his children to Jewish schools. Would Jewish law approve of this, and would this be legal in Ontario? So those are the 3 overall scenarios that I'm hoping to develop and discuss. You know, I will note that I'm not discussing the issue of litigating a will in secular court. There's a whole other discussion known as erkaos, dealing with litigating things in secular court. It's a great topic, but that would add another hour and a half to the session this morning. So I'm gonna hold that one. I'm also trying to give enough practical information that you'll be sensitized to the issues, but really any practical application should be reviewed with a rabbinic expert, because there are nuances, some of which we're going to see this morning, that really make this complicated. And I didn't even bring a formal form that one could use, because the application of this is very challenging. I will note, if you flip the sheets to the back page, you'll see at the bottom a bibliography, articles for further reading. Actually, the first one, Rachel Blumenfeld, is here. And it has a form. Her article has a form on the back page. Okay, she does not recommend using it. That's excellent. Okay, but these, all of which are available online, should provide some good further reading on the applications of this issue. Okay, so we have to begin, I think, first with the question of whether Judaism even wants people to write a will. Is that necessarily straightforward? Why might Jews feel uncomfortable writing a will? Can you think of a reason why Jews might feel uncomfortable writing a will? A halachic one, not because of legal issues. There is a concept in Judaism called ayin hara, Right? There are various versions of this, but basically a concern of that, a person can open themselves up to disaster by speaking certain ways, by opening up certain subjects. They could actually open themselves up to problems as a result. And why and how that works would add another 90 minutes to what we're going to talk about this morning, so I'm not really going to get into it. But there actually are those who are hesitant and who say, I don't want to speak about the possibility of my demise. I don't want to talk about and think about what happens after me. However, the strength of Jewish tradition is solidly behind the idea of writing a will. And there's a tradition of it, not only in terms of writing a will to take care of one's estate, which we find discussed Talmudically. There's actually a very interesting passage that talks about the ideal death and the ideal period of time leading up to death, and it suggests that an illness of a few days, enough to tell a person it's time to take care of his affairs, is ideal, so that a person has some opportunity to take care of it then. Of course, waiting until then may not be a good idea, because they may not get the few days. But we find the concept already there, and it's much discussed in terms of how people dispose of their estates. But also there's a tradition of ethical wills. The idea of leaving messages for one's heirs to tell them what one believed in and what one wants them to follow. And this is an old idea. Rav Shlomo Kluger was reported. Rav Shlomo Kluger was a rabbi in the city of Brod, in Lithuania, a couple of hundred years ago, a great halachic authority. And it is said that he said that one should do one's first will at the age of 50. Why the age of 50? Because there's a Mishnah in Pirkei Avot, which has various ethical teachings, which says that when one reaches the age of 50, one reaches the age of what's called Eitza, the age of counsel. And therefore, you're now able to give advice to people and to tell them what you think they should do. So, 50. Waiting for it. But that's one reason why, that's one idea. But more to the point, the default system that people will find, if they die not having left a will, the default system that will be employed by the government will not be consistent with the Torah's system for inheritance and necessarily the Torah's values. I noted here in source 2, for those who would like to look it up later, the Torah's order of inheritance, it says that in the event that a man dies and... only what was out on the table. In the event that a man dies, by default, he leaves his inheritance to his sons. In the event that there are no sons, then it goes to the daughters. And then if there are no sons and daughters, then it goes to his brothers. That's certainly not the system that you're going to see within a secular distribution. It may not be the optimal system within a Jewish distribution either. We're going to have to talk about that. I should note, just because the question comes up, why is the Torah leaving it to the sons? Why is the Torah excluding the daughters? So the general rule is that the Torah is, first of all, we do require that the daughters be supported. Make sure that's stated first. Both the wife and the daughters are indeed supported. And in the event that there isn't enough property for the support of both the sons and the daughters, the Talmud records that all the inheritance goes to the daughters and the sons are supposed to go begging at the doors. So that's point one, number one, to be aware of. Point number two to be aware of is that, generally speaking, it was understood that in the event that somebody passed away, the sons were ultimately going to be responsible to support whatever family they created, and the daughters, like it or not like it, apply it today or not, were going to be supported by their eventual husbands. And so therefore, the estate would go to the sons so that they would be able to support a family, and theoretically, if it was always passed down that way, it would work out well. There's more to be said on the topic, but that's just a basic note. So reason number one to write a will is because we have this tradition of writing one when one reaches age 50 in order to provide one's counsel to others. Reason number two is because if you don't, then you won't get the distribution that the Torah recommends. Number three is the problem that we're going to be hitting in our first vignette, and that is that if one doesn't write a will which conforms with Jewish law in some way, then there are those who will, in fact, not recognize the will, and will say that any property taken by heirs, which does not, in a system which does not fit Jewish law, would be considered theft. So that's a third reason. And then the fourth is, and that's what I wrote on your sheet in source number four, causing others to stumble. That means that the person who leaves the money to them is actually causing them to stumble potentially. And then the fourth is that there are non-financial issues that are covered in a will. For example, there's concern for custody of children. In the event that the will isn't written and the wishes are not made known, then you're vulnerable to whatever system governs in municipal law. So for all those reasons, it is important for one to write a will, despite concerns of ayin hara and speaking of what's going to happen after somebody is gone and so forth. So that brings me to our first question. The question of David, who wrote a will distributing his assets in accordance with local law, and his daughter says, "I'm not interested. I won't take a penny from such an estate." So, is Sarah right or wrong? In your experience, what have you heard people say?
The first question would be,
let's say it's
is she halakhically entitled?
Right. So let's say she's not halakhically entitled. There are brothers there, what she would be receiving from the estate would not fit the support that she should normally be getting, based on a simple Torah distribution. No one's ever heard this discussed. So generally speaking, it's popular to say that no, the secular will not be effective, and the reason why that is said is because of the issue of what's called matana la'achar misa, a gift that is posthumous. And the principle brought Talmudically is that a person's ability to transfer property ends with that person's death. The moment the person dies, that property then goes to whoever the halachic heirs are, whoever the heirs are under Jewish law. Let's say one says, well, I want to give a gift, and I'm going to give it now to be effective after death. Well, the problem is that you require what's called a kinyan. You require an act that cements the transaction that will take place at the time that the gift is given. And at that point, the person having passed away is not able to carry out such an act of kinyan. That's not going to work. If you take a look at source number 5 on your sheet, we find a passage from the Talmud. First, the Mishnah. Mishnah is the building block Jewish law text of the Talmud, recorded and canonized ultimately in the beginning of the 3rd century Common Era, but it's a verbal tradition going back much, much earlier. It says, "Tinumana le'ish ploni umes." If someone says, give a mana is a unit of currency, to so-and-so, and then he dies. Yitnu la'achar misa. The rule is that they give it after his death. So says the Mishnah. In other words, we're okay with the idea that they're going to give it after the person dies. Amar of Yitzchak, the Gemara, the commentary to the Mishnah then says, Amar of Yitzchak bar Shmuel bar Marta mishmei de Rav, Rav Yitzchak son of Shmuel son of Marta says, quoting Rav, v'hu shetzvurin umunachin bekeren zavis. He says, the only way you can do this is if the money is gathered together in a corner. To which the Gemara, the Talmud, then asks, what does gathering it together in a corner do? If you don't believe in posthumous gifts, who cares whether the money was sitting in a corner or was scattered everywhere or was somewhere in a bank account? What is this business of gathering it in the corner? Ilam Babari, if what you're talking about is a healthy person who said, give this gift, then kitzibur in my havi, hala mashach. Then what good does it do for it to be piled up somewhere? Ultimately, there was no act of kinyan, such as by taking the money. So that gift won't work. And if you'll tell me it's what's called a shchiv mirah, that the giver was on his deathbed, and if a person is on his deathbed and gives certain instructions about disposition of assets, those instructions may be honored even without an act of kinyan. It's a longer topic, and we're going to come back to it a little bit. But the idea is that a deathbed gift may indeed be honored, may indeed have the force of law, even if they don't have a kinyan. But he says, if it's a deathbed gift, then who cares whether the money was bunched together in a pile somewhere? It doesn't matter. Your gift is effective regardless. So the ultimate answer that's given here in source number 5 is that they're talking about a healthy person. But he gave the instruction of take this money and give it to so-and-so in front of the three parties who were involved. What happened was somebody else owed this person money, and he said to him, take that money and give it to a third party, and all three parties were present at the time, and that counted as the kinyan, because the money was present, and all the parties were present, that was a viable gift. But if you don't have that, then a healthy person's instruction of give my money to so-and-so is not effective after he's gone. And so what the Talmud here is saying is, matana la'achar misa, a posthumous gift, does not work within Jewish law. That's the statement. Yes, Tom?
Can he appoint the Sharia?
Could he appoint somebody to do it? It's a good question. The question was asked, can you appoint somebody and say, that person, executor, is going to be the one to take care of it. So once again, he'll require that the gift be given now. Not that the gift be posthumous. You can't have him do it for you afterwards. That's the
question.
Yeah.
Can you appoint the Sharia after?
Right. And the answer is no. He can't appoint the proxy for after he's gone. That's correct. So if you take a look at source number 6, you find the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, says, Bari Sha'amar Kispu Utenu Sada Zulaploni. If a healthy person says, record a deed and give this field to X to so and so. Im mechayim, then while he's alive, sure, kosvin venosnin, they can record the deed and they can give it to him. Ilo hader bey, kamei demata shtar liyadei, assuming that he doesn't back out before the deed reaches the recipient's hand. Avala achar misa, but once he's gone, ein kosvin venosnin elam kin kanu miyado. You can't do it unless there was a kinyan such that the gift was actually given while he was alive. So one might then say, so good, let him give it while he's alive. What's the problem with giving it while he's alive and doing the kinyan while he's alive? Sorry? He's lost his assets. He may need it at some point, right? If this person who's 50 years old says, I want to assign everything out and give it from now, and he lives to be 150, he's got 100 years in which he needs to support himself. So what's he supposed to do without his assets? Giving it and saying, I'm going to do my kinyan now and make the gift now, is probably not solid estate planning on the whole. This is not legal advice, though. So that's the problem. However, it's important to realize there is a concept in Jewish law called Dina de Malchusa Dina, which means the law of the land is binding. And so one might argue that since the law of the land is binding within Jewish law, meaning that when that I am responsible to follow the rules of the government insofar as they do not conflict with Torah law. Now let me unpack that for a moment. The rule is I am obligated to follow the laws of the land. So for example, the government says pay X percentage in taxes, I am responsible to pay X percentage in taxes. To cheat on one's taxes is not only a violation of secular law, it's a violation of Jewish law, because Jewish law says, Dina de Machusa, Dina, the law of the land is the law. The limit to that is, if the law of the land says that I have to violate Torah. So if the law of the land is, everyone has to eat a ham sandwich on Thursdays, then no, at that point, I don't follow Dina de Machusa, I would not follow the law of the land. But otherwise, that's something that I am responsible to follow. So one might argue that given that the law of the land is binding, so this should work. This secular will, even though it's a posthumous gift, even though you're giving something, one is giving something after they have passed away, nonetheless, it should be valid. What's the argument against that? Sorry? So Andrea suggests maybe it goes against Torah law, but it's not necessarily against Torah law, as long as the parties involved agree to it. The Torah has no objection to people transferring something posthumously.
Right. After you pass away.
Right.
According to Jewish law, you not do that.
Right. But it's not that it's against Jewish law, it's that Jewish law says it doesn't work. So in other words, in the event that somebody were to leave property to one's children using secular law, and granted the Jewish law system did not accept the idea of a posthumous gift, what violation of Jewish law would actually be involved if somebody went with a secular system and distributed everything? What would he be in violation of? So one possibility is to suggest, as Andrea points out, there are certain distributions that the Torah seems to expect of us, such as giving a double portion to the firstborn. I forgot to mention that earlier. If there's a firstborn male, then he's supposed to receive a double portion. Am I in violation of Jewish law by taking away this portion from the firstborn male? That might be one concern. Another concern is the concern for theft. If Jewish law says that this heir has the right to it, then by using the secular system and saying, well, dina de machusa, this is the law of the land, maybe I'm guilty of theft for transferring it away to somebody else. That's another concern. It's also important to realize that the principle of dina de machusa dina, that the law of the land is the law, is stated when you're dealing with issues that are between Jews and non-Jews. But generally speaking, for matters between Jews and Jews, we say, you're supposed to be working with Jewish law. You're Jews, you should be working with Jewish law. And that's another reason why this is difficult to apply. That it's difficult to just say, dina de machusa dina, that the law of the land is the law. And therefore, indeed, the claim is that somebody who transferred using a secular law would actually be guilty of theft. However, there is an argument to say that a secular law works not under dina de malchusa, but because of dina de malchusa. I'll explain what that means. Not that because the secular system recognizes this distribution, therefore it's valid, but rather because the person who wrote the will knew that the courts were going to enforce that which was recorded there. They had what's called gemirus das. They concluded in their mind that this is for sure what is going to happen, and that may well be the equivalent of the kinyan, the act of transaction which cements a deal. If you take a look at source number 7, the Hebrew is at the bottom of one side, the English is at the top of the next side. This is a brief quote from none other than Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, one of the greatest authorities in Jewish law of the 20th century. And he writes, "Be'etzem mistaber l'fiyani yizdaiti." He says, it makes sense, in my humble opinion, "shetzava kazu," that a will like this, a secular will, "shavada yiskayim," it will be upheld, "kedivrei hametzava," in accordance with the words of the person who commanded it, "bedina demalchusa," with the law of the land. Why? He says, "Eino tzarech kinyan she'ein lecha kinyan gadol mizeh." He says it doesn't require a formal act of kinyan, a formal act of transaction, because there's no greater kinyan than the fact that the government is going to enforce it. Meaning, the goal of an act of kinyan is that it demonstrates the seriousness of the parties involved, and it says, we are going through with this. So what more serious a thing can you have than the fact that the courts are willing to honor that which is written in the document? And therefore, Moshe Feinstein said, such a document would in fact be valid. In preparing for this, Rabbi Feinstein's response is fairly well known, and you can find various articles on it, agreeing with it, disagreeing with it, and so on. But in preparing for this, I found something that I had not heard about before at all. There's a kollel in Israel called Kollel Eretz Chemda, run by Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, Rav Yosef Carmel, who visits here in Toronto every year or so. They deal with many contemporary issues, and they deal with questions from all over the world. So they have a set of books called Bemarei HaBazak, where they publish their responsa, and it's a great read. It's also entertaining, because at the top of each one, they tell you in big, bold letters where in the world the question came from. It's like Lima, and Torino, Italy, and wherever else, all these different places they're sending questions to Kol Eretz Chemda. So they had a question, indeed, about accepting a will with a secular distribution, and in a footnote, and for those who want to look it up, it's in volume 4, it's number 137, it's footnote 6 in there. They report that Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik had such a will, that he had such a secular will. He did not use a halachic will. And that's a very important point, because his word carries great weight in terms of what one would do in practice. I tried to investigate and find out a little bit more, you know, to get some corroborating evidence, because I'd never heard this before. I sent it out to a listserv of rabbis that I'm on, including many who are close, and I got responses like, yes, I know someone very close to the family who confirms this. So I have reason to believe that it's true, although I would have liked to have seen it in writing from him or from you know, from one of his close students, especially because several of his close students have written on the topic and don't like the secular will. So I'm curious about it. Nonetheless, that would be a very important thing in terms of precedent if, in fact, Rabbi Soloveitchik used a secular will. So what you see here is a basis for not accepting it, not accepting the secular will, recognizing it as a posthumous gift, which Jewish law would not accept. On the other hand, the possibility of saying that what we're really looking for is kinyan, the act that demonstrates the seriousness of what you're doing, and if, in fact, the certainty that the courts are going to enforce it qualifies, as Rabbi Feinstein argues, then you can just have a secular distribution. We still have to deal with the question of, well, wait a minute, you're not satisfying the Torah system. What are you going to do about that? And we're going to come back to that shortly. But it would seem that that would then work according to that argument. And again, various figures reject this point. They say fundamentally this isn't an act of kinyan, it isn't an act of transaction, and therefore they aren't willing to accept it. It is much debated. And so to go back to our case, where Sarah comes back to her father, David, and says, I'm not willing to take it, it depends on which authority Sarah is following. But indeed, she may have reason to reject what's been given to her. Tommy.
Is there a difference between Israel and Israel?
So apparently not. He asked if there's a difference between where the estate is in Israel and elsewhere. I don't believe there's a distinction. I haven't seen...
The document itself, it's made in Israel.
Right, so no. Because
of... Moshe Feinstein is referring to Wurzlaar, it's obviously...
Right. Right, but I don't believe that. I understand that. I think I understand what you're getting at, but I don't believe so. It's worth noting that this is then an issue not only for some, you know, for a client who is personally observant of Jewish law and says, I'd like you to help me, but it's also relevant for a client who has heirs who are observant of Jewish law. And the client comes to you and says, I want to write a will. And you say, well, this person doesn't particularly concern himself with Jewish law, so therefore I can just write a regular will. Not so fast. If that's going to create problems among his children, then you might want to think carefully about how to advise the client. Raquel, you were going to say?
Yeah, I'm just wondering if in the discussion people have on the bushes, saying that this is like a self-opinion, that there's something that would be revoked,
It's really funny. I was wondering about that as I was saying it. It's a good question she asks. You know, it isn't necessarily so clear that having written a will, it's going to be carried out. Even, you know, forget anything to do with Jewish wills. Just, you know, wills get challenged. There are issues that can be revoked also, and therefore theoretically changed along the way. How much of a kinyan really is it if you know that 5 years from now you might, you know, write something different? I haven't seen anyone make the point, but I wonder about it also. It's a good question. So, having said that some will recognize the secular will and some will not, how can you do something that's going to satisfy everybody? So generally speaking, in a Jewish law discussion, that's a bad question to ask. Nonetheless, we're going to see what the options are for satisfying everybody. So yeah, there are certain possibilities that get discussed that I don't want to spend a lot of time on, because they have flaws that are, if not fatal, nearly fatal, and make their implementation really unlikely. So, for example, the argument is made in certain cases that kibud av va'em. Kibud av va'em means honor your parents. And therefore, if the parents say, I don't care, you know, what the secular system says, I want you to make sure that so-and-so gets this and so-and-so gets that, the children have to honor their parents. To which I respond, that's a wonderful idea. Good luck. If you're going to make your will on that basis, you better know your children really, really well. It's true, theoretically, they could all forgive each other's claims. You know, in a family in which everything is wonderful, they could all forgive each other's claims by halacha and say, but we're going to give it out this way, and you know, that's wonderful if they can do it. But I don't think it's something to really rely on. There's also the recognition of what I called before the matnas shchiv mera, the gift from somebody who is on his deathbed. And it's true that a person who makes declarations about distribution of assets on his deathbed will have those words honored. Those have power within Jewish law. However, once again, that's a poor way to do your estate planning. Right? If a person is going to just count on having a deathbed and having competence when they are on their deathbed, having capacity and so on, that may not work out so well. So again, I discount that. The third one that I wanted to mention, only to discount, is what's called mitzvah lekayim divrei hames. That there is a mitzvah of fulfilling the words of someone who has passed away. And there is, in fact, such a principle. And it's useful in one particular situation. Rabbi Jachter, who I quote in the bibliography, and it's worth seeing there, talks about the relevance of mitzvah lekayim divrei hames for designation of beneficiaries, for insurance, for various accounts, RRSPs, and so forth in Canada. There, the whoever was designated as a beneficiary may receive it in a way that's recognized by Jewish law, because that is like an instruction given by the person who passed away, and therefore others have to honor it. The reason why, in general, it isn't great as something to rely on, say, well, I'll write the secular will and count that as the instruction of somebody who passed away, and therefore they have to listen, is that mitzvah l'kayim divrei hames may only apply to assets that are actually there at the time that the instruction is made. So you couldn't say it about things that are in the future. It may require kinyan, it may require some kind of formal act of transaction, and there are various other requirements and nuances that I think make it very difficult for a person to rely on this, and so I don't want to spend a lot of time on this. What I want to move to instead are at least four other methods that I've seen discussed. So the first one is what is called an inter vivos gift with retained life interest. Person says, I'm going to give the gift right now, as I am here alive, and I retain ownership to the extent that the asset is mine, I'm able to make use of it. If there were any proceeds from it, I would be able to have them right now, but it's a gift from now, and it'll be effective after it will remain effective after death. So a couple of points regarding this. First of all, take a look at source number 8. This is where you find the concept in the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law. Yes.
Basically, a person giving themselves a power of attorney to themselves. That's basically what it
is. I don't think so. It's actually a gift. It's not.
No, but they're still giving power of attorney to them to control their own assets.
Right. I think applying the term trust to it. I'm reluctant to use the word trust only because I don't understand all the nuances of what I know. My wife is a lawyer and she worked in trusts and estates, and so she distinguished for me the difference between gifts and trusts enough so that I know I don't know the difference between gifts and trusts. I want to be very careful about using it. But if you're comfortable saying it's a trust, then great. Yes.
I would suggest maybe it's an outright gift subject to retaining a life interest.
Right, and that was my understanding of it, but hey, take a look at what you see here in number 8, because that's the definitive sort of Shulchan Aruch, Code of Jewish Law description. Hakosev nechasev livno la'achar moso. The person writes his property to his children after his death. Hari aguf shall ben mizman hashtar. So the body of the property belongs to the child who receives it from the time written on the document, meaning while the parent is alive. Vaperos la'avachiyamus. And then the produce, if it's a field, so it's generating produce, that'll go to the father until his death. Leficha ha'av einu yachol limkor mipnei shem nesudim leben. So the father loses the right to transfer that property to anybody else because he has already written it to the son. The son owns the body of the property. Vaben einu yachol limkor mipnei shem birshus ha'av. And the son can't sell it because the father also has rights to it until the father passes away. So the property belongs to the father and the son in some sense. Each of them has some hold on the property. One thing that's very important to note is in source number 9, Jewish and American Inheritance Law. This is one of the articles I listed in the bibliography. It is available online from Donna Lippman and Stephen Reznikoff. I think he might be Rabbi Stephen Reznikoff. I'm not 100% sure. But if you look at number 9, they note the following concern. The transfer of a future interest also requires that the kinyan be accompanied by appropriate language. When you do the act of transaction that cements this, you need the right language. Thus, a transferor who wants to retain beneficial ownership until just before death could state, or include in any deed, this transfer is from now and until one moment before I die. By this language, the transferor will retain the right to possession of the property until the moment before death, when that right will vest in the transferee. Because of the transferor's death, the property belongs completely to the transferee. The transferor's Torah heirs receive nothing. So the language has to be that you're actually giving the gift from now. That's one important point. It can't be said that this is an eventual gift. Number 2, it takes effect immediately. And it's now, as we said, irrevocable. Like the Shulchan Aruch said, like the Code of Jewish Law said, the father no longer has any ability to do anything else with it. He changes his mind, he wants to change his will, he's out of luck. Number 3 is that it requires kinyan. It will require that there be a formal act of transaction, which sometimes is very simple and sometimes is a lot more complicated depending on the type of property you're transferring. Sometimes it's simple as what's called a kinyan sudar, where you can take a pen and pick it up, or a handkerchief and pick it up, and that signifies your acceptance of the deal. And sometimes it's a lot more complicated than that. There are various problems with using this method. What do you see already as a problem with using this method, Horace? Correct. You need to clarify what is supposed to happen. That's one possible concern is if one parent gave it and then the other parent is going to be out of luck. Another concern that's going to happen, I think this was in your article, Rachel, is what happens if there's a period in between when the donor, let's say it's a house, the donor was living in the house, and now the donor can't live in the house any longer, but is still alive. So now what's the standing, what's the status of that property? So yes, those are concerns.
This is another thing. Estate taxes are based on property or anything else that's after death.
Yeah.
Would this be considered as a gift, therefore estate taxes will not apply?
Right. So it would be very important to make sure, this is another concern, that gifts are executed in a way that the state is actually going to recognize. We're going to come back to that issue, in a bit. So I'll talk more about it then. But that's actually a major problem with many of these. Is the state going to look at this as a gift? Is the state going to look at this as a way to get around the estate distribution? That's a problem we have to address. A major problem is that it only works for property that one has at the time of the transfer. Right? The person who is writing this, let's say they're, as the Shlomo Kluger prescribed, they're 50 years old. Right? Who knows what they're going to acquire between then and the time they pass away? It's not like you can just assume that whatever one has now is the extent of one's property forever. There are various consequences. This is some of it. Actually, if you take a look at number 10, one note on the tax consequences. There are a number of practical and legal drawbacks to this solution, not the least of which is the loss of control by the donor over his or her property. As well, there would be tax consequences to the transfer if there is an accrued gain realized on the distribution, unless the property is a principal residence. If the donor does wish to proceed with a transfer of this nature, it is important to document what is to occur if, for example, the donor is unable to continue living in the property. There was the case. That was the line. I knew I had put it here somewhere. The tax consequences of giving that gift are, I think, a significant point. There are versions of this with various stipulations to work around some of the concerns, but fundamentally, this is a problematic way to go about things. It's not a great solution. It'll work from a halachic perspective. assuming you, you know, do with a Kenyan and so on. But it's really not a great way to do things. The second method that I'm going to suggest has two versions of it, but they both operate on the same principle. And this is the one that I have seen quoted most as the way to go about the to go about the distribution. And this is what is called, essentially, as I wrote on your sheet, the heading over number 11, an artificial debt. And what it means is, well, take a look at source number 11. I'll let the Shulchan Aruch tell you. The Code of Jewish Law says the following. If someone obligates himself to pay another person some money unconditionally, even though he didn't owe him anything from before, he indeed owes it to the person. So in other words, there's somebody who I owe nothing to, he owes me nothing, we're friends. And one day, I stand up in front of witnesses and say, you know, I owe Moshe $1,000. It doesn't matter whether Moshe ever lent me $1,000. It doesn't matter whether there's been any sort of financial transaction between us at all. What the Code of Jewish Law is saying is, from a Jewish law perspective, I am able to create an artificial debt. As though he had in fact lent me that that money. And they give an example right here, but it's basically what I just said. The, he says to the witnesses, I want you to witness that I owe so-and-so a money, again, a unit of currency. I write it in a document. Whatever it is, I owe the money to that person. And that leads to the following solution. You get to witnesses, and you document... Either you write it, you do verbally, but you want to write it, that you owe a certain amount to the person you want to have receive this money, or really to anybody, I suppose, technically, but you create some debt that's so large that it would wipe out the estate, or so large enough that they're going to take this very seriously, and you say, listen, I owe that money to so-and-so. However, in the event that my heirs do as I wish with my assets, then that debt is considered discharged. You follow? What you're doing is you're saying, I owe $20 million to so-and-so. However, in the event that you distribute the assets this way, and I want you to have equal portions for all the children, or make sure this one gets the pool, or whatever it is, then... forget the $20 million debt. That $20 million debt is gone. That's the method. You follow? I'm going to talk about a nuance on that, you know, soon. But that's the basic concept. If you take a look at source number 12, we'll talk about the weaknesses of it in a minute. But take a look at source number 12. It is worth noting that there may be a need for a kinyan. There may be a need for an act of transaction regarding this this gift that you give. The Rambam, Maimonides, writes that that is a requirement. The reason for the kinyan is because of a concern for something called asmachta. Asmachta means a case in which someone says something, makes some kind of legal commitment, but never expects to have to carry it out. They don't really take it seriously. And such a statement, if you make a legal statement, but you don't ever intend to carry it out, it's not binding. So what you do by performing this act of kinyan is you demonstrate that you are serious, that this is for real, and in the event that they don't distribute the assets in accordance with your wishes, then in fact the this debt is going to have to be paid off. There are advantages to doing this. For starters, a person can do this without any knowledge of what's going to be in the estate after however many years. It doesn't make a difference, right? All they're saying is, this amount of money is owed, regardless, so I want you to make sure you distribute the assets, this percentage to so-and-so, this amount to so-and-so, and although some do require, I shouldn't say that quite so quickly, some require that the way you distribute it be by amounts and not by percentages. There is that. But the but basically, this would be, it seems, a solid way to handle the problem, except for one issue. Well, except for two issues. One issue is a Jewish law issue. The other one is a secular law issue. The Jewish law issue relates to the situation of a married woman. Because within Jewish law, if a woman is married and she passes away, her husband is the immediate heir of the property, and he already has a controlling interest within the property. I believe I actually noted this on the sheet. Yes, if you take a look at source number 15, I'm jumping over the ones that are before it in the interest of time, but take a look at 15 from the Litman and Reznikoff article. A husband is first in line to inherit from his wife. In addition, however, a husband's rights are deemed to have vested at the outset of the marriage. He's considered like a creditor from the beginning of the marriage. Consequently, even if during the marriage the woman were to admit a great debt to a third party, this would not affect the husband's rights. Given that his rights preceded the indebtedness to the third party, the husband would have prior rights to the wife's estate. You follow? Remember, the husband has a responsibility which he takes upon himself at marriage to support and take care of his wife in a variety of ways, many of which are financial, but in exchange for that, he is going to have rights over her property. That's the trade-off. So, given that, any debt she admits is essentially for a creditor who came along after the husband did, unless she did this before she got married. So what are you going to do? So he writes, or they write, consequently, for a married woman to use this device, she needs her husband's cooperation. The husband should sign a separate admission of indebtedness that falls due on his wife's death. This document, however, should provide that this indebtedness is deemed fully paid and discharged if he fulfills the gift set forth in his wife's will. So in other words, he has to write off the same type of a document saying that this debt has primacy. And in the event that in the event that his wife passes away, that debt will kick in unless they discharge as requested in the wife's will.
Family law basically both are responsible for having that. It's a type of civil law. You may end up there. As long as the debt is after you are married, both parties are responsible for the debt. No one person.
Right, but I'm talking about from the Jewish law perspective, the credit, the debt is to him. Okay. Yes?
Can you make that same assumption that you can go to your children and say that, make them sign an acknowledgement of indebtedness and don't lay the scheme of distribution in your will?
Yeah, let's have them do it.
Yeah, I mean, if you want, you know, obviously not follow the law.
I suppose.
Scheme of distribution, you go to your children in advance and say, look, sign this acknowledgement that you give up your share of the.
Yeah, no, hypothetically, yes. You know, you could get them all. I mean, essentially what you're doing is just another variation on having them forgive their rights to each other. But, you know, again, that assumes that you have children who are going to go along with this. That's not necessarily, you know, something to rely on. But yes, hypothetically, that could work. Yeah.
The other assumption, too, I'm assuming, is that the debtor is Jewish and observant that goes along with this scheme.
Yeah, I mean, everybody has to be going along with this.
Well, no, but I mean that they follow Jewish law, but the potential death.
Correct. Yes? Right, and that's number 16.
So that's why what family law says about it doesn't matter because it doesn't exist under. There is no obligation as far as secular law is concerned. There's only an obligation as long as law is concerned.
Just to read out number 16 from Litman and Reznikoff, because Raquel makes an important point. This was the secular law concern. As a general rule, American law does not enforce an obligation or deem it legally binding when a person voluntarily undertakes an obligation to another without consideration or a consideration substitute. So I don't actually know whether $1 works as consideration or whether something more substantive is needed. Sorry? Yeah?
You don't need consideration. But you also don't need to be doing it. You don't actually want it to exist under halakha. Because as far as secular law is concerned, your secular will is going to be what secular law cares about.
discharge on the estate, that they're going to only be able to discharge by following the secular will. So the secular law only cares about the secular will.
Right. So Raquel's point, just to make sure everybody can hear it, is that the goal of creating this debt is fundamentally to make sure that your heirs are going to follow the secular law, and therefore it doesn't matter whether the secular courts will recognize this debt or not. The only piece of it that I'm not sure about, though, is what if some of the children are not observant of halacha and are going to say, well, we don't care about this. If it was recognized in the secular courts, such as by doing it under seal, if that worked, then there would be teeth to this. Right, but you're working with two different systems and potentially two different groups within the heirs.
I think the best point is that the two groups, if you
can satisfy each of them.
Could be. The ones who care about halacha are going to have this halachic obligation that they have, that charge on the state, that they have to discharge
right.
by following the secular will.
Right.
And the ones who don't care about halacha are just going to go straight to the secular will.
That's an interesting point.
Everybody ends up with the secular will. The problem is, of course, you start to challenge.
Well, if they start challenging, or if you have somebody within the group who doesn't particularly care which system as long as they get what they want and will play one side against the other, then you could run into trouble. See, that might be a concern, but I definitely hear what you're saying. We've been waiting a long time.
I was actually going to make the same point. So, no. And the only thing I would add to that is it all depends. The premise is that the secular will, as a secular will be enforceable. So if there's some kind of distribution outside of secular law, like you should be giving under secular law, wife has a right to equalization or something like that, then that would be an issue. But as long as the secular will is enforceable as a secular will, then this takes care of the halakhic considerations. For those who care about the halakhic considerations and those who don't care about the halakhic considerations, it's irrelevant to them.
Right. I hear. Leah. Right. I mean, you can imagine a situation in which one of them says, okay, I'm now $20 million richer. Right. Yes, and that exists. So there's another version of this, which is good to know about. It's what's called a shtar chatzi zachar, and this is an old way to take care of this. If you take a look at source number 17, you'll see it. Right, Moshe Isserles, writing in 16th century Poland, says, Umasha noagin b'shtar chatzi zachar. The practice of what we call shtar chatzi zachar, literally shtar chatzi zachar, means the deed of or the bill of half of a male. That's literally what the term means. So what do? Shekosvim achshav lebanos shenolin b'chol asher yimatzei lo kamo azcharim. They write that the daughter is going to receive like the males, like the sons. He writes, I admit that I owe her a certain sum of money. And they will not be exempt from this obligation unless they give her like they give the males. And that way it isn't even about what's currently in the estate, it can be on future assets as well. So in some places this was done to give them half of what a male would get. Why only half? So there are some who suggest it was done in order to retain this biblical primacy of the sons in the estate. However, various authorities say that there's no reason why it couldn't be full, and you could give them a full share. And we're going to talk about that more when we talk about changing the order of inheritance, which is coming up. But the basic approach that we're talking about here is the approach of creating an artificial debt of one form or another in order to enforce upon them the distribution according to whatever it is that you want to see happen. And this will avoid the secular will, halachic will problem. Are we clear on how this works? Okay. A third suggestion, and this is actually from Rachel's document, so I just quoted it in source number 18, is joint tenancy. Transferring and holding assets in joint tenancy with children during lifetime may be a solution to the halachic issue of distributing assets to daughters on death. However, in Canada, one must proceed cautiously. Right? You understand the basic idea, holding assets in joint tenancy. So if the father and his daughter are joint tenants of the property, then as I understand it, what that means is when the father passes away, it simply goes to his daughter. And it's not an estate. It's not a will. It's simply now she is the owner of the property. But note the concern here. There may be tax implications to a transfer to joint tenancy where a true joint tenancy is created, as the parent may be considered to be disposing of one half of the property, right? Imagine a situation in which the father owns the estate and then says, okay, I'm now entering into joint tenancy with my daughter. Is he disposing of half of his property now as a gift to his daughter? Right? Potentially, the answer is yes. And therefore, that could have tax consequences. And then, in light of the Pequor and Saylor decisions, which I'll explain in a moment, if the property is transferred to one of several children with the intention that the child is to distribute the property among several siblings, the property may be considered to fall back into the estate to be divided according to the will. In other words, if a person says they want to give ownership of the property to the child so that the child is going to essentially act as an executor, the child is going to be the one to distribute everything, then the courts may look at that and say, what you're trying to do is just get around an estate. What you're trying to do is get around an estate distribution. And unless I'm wrong, I thought that the driving concern here is that you're trying to get around the estate tax. That's really what this is about. So they're going to look at this and say, this wasn't really a joint tenancy at all. And they're going to say, this is really going to go back to being an estate distribution. That's what I got out of Pequor and Saylor. I hope that I understood them correctly.
There's more nuances to it. But
yes.
I think for these purposes,
yeah. Right. So, that said, if, as discussed above, there had been a proper kinyan at the time of the transfer into joint tenancy, the child holding the property at the death of the parent should be able to distribute it in accordance with the will without offending the halacha. So, if you can deal with the tax and legal issues properly, then yes, this would seem to be a valid way to handle the problem. The child is now the owner of the property upon the death of the parent, and the child can do whatever they want, and halacha will recognize it without a problem. And so that's a third approach. The last approach that I wanted to mention is the inter vivos trust. And that's Rabbi Jachter's note in source number 19, where he says, what you want to do is put it into a living trust, where the trustee has the power to spend the money on behalf of the beneficiaries. And you give the trustee instructions for how to distribute it, and then the trustee will have to follow the instructions of the deceased under the principle I mentioned earlier, that there's a mitzvah fulfilling the words of the deceased. So take a look at number 19. A new suggestion may provide a halachically viable solution to the Yerusha. Yerusha is inheritance. To the Yerusha issues, in a manner that is consistent with common secular legal and estate planning for many people. This involves establishing a revocable living trust, a contractual arrangement between a person as the grantor forming the trust, preferably that person and another person as co-trustees managing the trust, and he and his family members as beneficiaries to receive the economic benefits of the trust. This approach to a living trust is fundamentally different from the more simplistic approach of most living trusts, in which one would be the sole grantor, trustee, and beneficiary until death. The latter approach, the simplistic one, is less likely to be respected as a valid entity under halacha. If the former kind of trust can be regarded as a legal entity, a third party, by halacha, and the subsequent transfers of one's assets to such a trust characterized as lifetime gifts, this commonly used secular planning technique may afford a new method of complying with the Torah requirements concerning Yerusha, concerning inheritance. That's what he is suggesting. You would create this this trust, and with instructions that ultimately the trustee is going to be the one to distribute it properly. So there are two potential problems here. One problem is tax implications. In putting this into the trust, and I did note, you mentioned in your article the alter ego trust or the self-benefit trust, but I'm not sure that the rules for use of the funds in that way will comply with the halachic requirements in order to, for this, the problem is that within halacha, the property in the trust has to be recognized as being owned by the trustee. And I'm not sure if the rules of the alter ego trust or the self-benefit trust will actually allow that. That's one concern. And the other is not everyone within halacha, within the halachic system, recognizes a trust. He noted it here. In the quote, he said, if the former kind of trust can be regarded as a legal entity by halacha, there's a lot of discussion of whether a trust can be considered a person, so to speak. How do we view incorporated entities within halacha? And that may sabotage this as well. But what we've seen are four methods. Assuming that you don't accept the argument that the secular will works, as Rabbi Feinstein suggested, because there is Gemirus Das, there's the understanding that the government is going to enforce it, then what you have are four possible approaches. There were others that I mentioned briefly. Getting the children to forgive it to each other is wonderful. And if you have children who will do that, then your life will be much easier, and you deserve Gan Eden for the wonderful job you did on raising these children. But unfortunately, since that's not always the case, there's the future inter vivos gift with retained life interest. The weakness of that being that it only works for stuff that you actually own at the time that you are writing up this will. It can't be done on things that are not yet owned. That's one of the weaknesses. We mentioned some others. There's the artificial debt approach, where you say a sum is owed to so-and-so unless they distribute the assets according to the will, which is essentially the forgiving approach. You're asking them all to forgive it to each other. You're just giving it teeth by saying, and if you don't, there's going to be this major debt. The third approach would be the joint tenancy, and the last, the inter vivos trust. So that brings me to the last part. And again, in case anybody is going to need to leave early, make sure, please, that you sign in. There are sheets around on top. Where are the sheets right now? The sign-in sheets? Okay. Also, I will probably, later today, I will probably send out, today or at some point this week, send out an email to those who signed in. And included in the email will be the digital version of this source sheet, which is good because I didn't have enough copies for everybody, but it's also good because the links that are in the bibliography are a lot easier to click on than they are to retype. So if you get the digital version of this, you'll be able to get those links more easily. Okay, the last section here. A person wants to structure a will, and the way we framed it in the vignette back in the beginning was that he wants to exclude his son from the will if his son does not send his children to Jewish schools. You can imagine all sorts of variations on this. And the question is this advisable from a Jewish law perspective? How does Jewish law look at subverting the order of inheritance as prescribed within the Torah? And also, will this indeed be legal in Ontario? So, dealing with the secular law concern first, As I understand it, I was in a B'nai B'rith program about this a couple of years ago, within Canadian law, and there are differences among provinces, so I shouldn't use the term Canadian, but within the binding secular law, the children have a right to the estate. I always found this very funny. It seems like Canada is going the way of a European policy in which the children are viewed almost as creditors to the estate, and that the estate, this is actually theirs. And the reason I find this very funny is that there's this thing called an estate tax. If it really belongs to the children, by what right is the government taxing this as though it was a transaction? Right, to which the answer is they need the money and therefore they're going to do it. The house always wins. But the it strikes me that this isn't really the way things should be done. But that's a very real issue, is if someone is going to disinherit an heir, they need to have a reason that does not violate the government's concerns and public policy concerns, or the government will say, what you're doing is you're cheating your creditor. If you take a look at source 20, I took this from an article from Chuck Wagoner, When is a Disappointed Heir a Defrauded Creditor? He says, a seminal case in this area is Stone v. Stone. In 1995, multimillionaire Harry Stone hatched a plan to ensure that his wife of 24 years, Sarah Stone, would get very little upon his death. In particular, Harry wanted to make sure that his commercial wealth would go to his children from a prior marriage. The problem for Harry, of course, was the Family Law Act, which lets the surviving spouse seek equalization against the estate in the same way that a spouse might on a divorce. Harry tried to thwart his wife's rights under the Family Law Act by transferring his assets to his children before he died. So he's trying to give his children a gift so that it won't go to his wife. But his wife has rights under the law. She has certain expectations. The result was that when Harry passed away on July 21, 1995, there was virtually nothing left in his estate. Essentially, Harry was preventing his wife from exercising her claim under the Family Law Act for an equalization of net family property. In this case, Ontario Court of Appeal recognized the possibility of using the Fraudulent Conveyances Act to set aside transfers, quote, there's a quote from the Act, made with intent to defeat, hinder, delay, or defraud creditors or others of their just and lawful action suits, debts, accounts, damages, penalties, or forfeitures. In Stone v. Stone, the court held that as a spouse who held rights under the Family Law Act at the time of the fraudulent conveyances, i.e. the right to seek equalization, Sarah was a creditor or other within the meaning of the Fraudulent Conveyances Act. Accordingly, Harry's transfers to his kids were declared void, and Sarah received an equalization payment of $851,937. I am not the author of the article. If you want to talk to Chuck, you can. The statement is that in this case, the spouse had a right, but the heirs also are considered to have a right to the estate. And there have been cases now. British Columbia had a particular one called Tatarin, but where people had clauses that were intended to induce their children to marry someone of a particular race, a particular religion, or they disapproved of their child's lifestyle, and if the child pursues that lifestyle, then they're going to disinherit them. And because in Canada one is not allowed to discriminate on various grounds, that's considered to violate public policy. So this sort of thing is not simple and straightforward from a secular law perspective. Yes?
Yes.
Yeah.
But there's a case where they said there were some cases recently where it seemed like Ontario was moving towards this.
Yes.
And there was a case last year where they said, no, there's no freestanding right for a child to stay. There are ways to get it, you're dependent, but there's no freestanding right. So
right.
You do kind of take back into the public policy considerations as opposed to the fraudulent conveyances that, you know,
Right. No, that's true. I should distinguish between the two. The Fraudulent Conveyances Act is saying they are actually creditors. Like, they have a right to the estate. The public policy one is more flexible, and you're more apt to see that applied, at least currently, in Ontario. But I've been looking at some of the case law, but certainly I'm no expert on it. But that's a consideration. So Spence was one I was thinking of, but I wasn't going to go into it. Did you want to say something about it in particular?
Just other than that, I mean, it's under appeal, so we don't know where it'll go, like where the court basically said, yes, we're going to look at things like public policy and discrimination on the basis of race as a basis for overturning.
Right. And that's Spence's Ontario. Yeah, that's my understanding. So I think you are going to see this, you know, in a very real way here. And so that's one concern with this person who says, I want to disinherit if they don't send their kids to, you know, to Jewish schools. What about from a Jewish law perspective? So there is sort of this, there is this sense that people have that, you know, a Jewish parent would in fact disinherit for a whole host of things that they don't like. But really, that's actually not consistent with Jewish tradition. We do view the Torah's order of inheritance as important, as significant. If you take a look at source number 22, a passage from the Talmud, it says, Hakosev es nechasav la'acherim. If a person writes away his property to other people, v'iniach es banav, and he leaves the children saying, the children aren't getting, masha'asa asui, what's done is done, meaning it's valid, ela ein ruach hachamim nocha himenu. However, the sages are displeased. They don't like people. It's legally valid, but the sages are not happy with that sort of conduct. And Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel says, not so fast. He says, it depends. If the children aren't behaving properly, then zachor latov, then he is remembered for the good. So you see different positions there. But as you move into the Gemara on this, the discussions of this in the Talmud, I thought I had brought a particular quote that I see that I did not. They disapproved, the sages disapproved of sitting on a rabbinical court for a redistribution where one says, I don't want my my children to get. They were not happy with this concept. I did bring you source number 23 from the Jerusalem Talmud. Amar Rabbi Abba Bar Mamol. Rabbi Abba Bar Mamol said, HaKosev nechasav la'acherim b'niach es banav. If a person writes away his property to others, leaving his sons, meaning abandoning them, Allahu Omer Vatihi Avonosam Al Atzmosam. There's a biblical verse, their sins were upon their bones. This person has, in other words, sinned. It's saying, no, you're not supposed to transfer it away. There is a sense that one's heirs have some right to the property. If you take a look at source number 24, Rabbi Yeshua Falk, writing in the 16th century, says the Torah assigns to the heirs certain rights when it presents the order of inheritance. That the heirs should in fact stand in the place of those who bequeath the property. There is a power to the order of inheritance as it is stated within the Torah, and the Rambam Maimonides codifies it in source number 25. He says indeed that one is not supposed to disinherit, and he says you're not supposed to testify to a will that transfers inheritance from the heir. It should really be avoided. There's a lot more that could be said about that, but that's one point, which is generally speaking, we honor the order of inheritance and we don't disinherit. At the same time, lest one then ask, so does that mean I'm supposed to write up my will in such a way that my firstborn son is now going to get a double portion? And make sure my daughters are going to be supported from the estate but not get the land? Is that really where we're going? The answer is not necessarily. Because Jewish authorities recognize that for a whole host of reasons, varying the order of inheritance may make sense. If you take a look, I brought in source number 26 from Rabbi Moshe Isserles. That same Rama, the same Rabbi Moshe Isserles who records the importance of observing the order of inheritance, says, says, Bari Sherotz Elachlok Nechasav Achre Moso Shalo Yerivu Yorshav Acharav. If you have a healthy person, not a deathbed gift, you have a person who is healthy, and he wants to distribute his assets after death in such a way that he will prevent fighting among his heirs. Verotz Elaso Seder Tzava Ba'odo Bari. He wants to arrange the instructions while he's healthy. Tzarech Lahaknos Bekinyan. So he has to have this act of kinyan, which we talked about earlier. He has to perform a formal transaction. But what Rabbi Yisrael says that's of note for our discussion is that it may well be wise to distribute things differently and not to follow the strict order of inheritance that I presented, or noted at any rate, in source number two. He says, one may want to do differently in order to prevent fighting among the heirs. And that's one consideration. Another consideration is the mitzvah of tzedakah, that one is supposed to take care of one's family. And what happens if somebody has one heir who is doing very well in business, and you have another one who is having trouble? So that's a legitimate reason also to say, I want to redistribute. I don't want to keep the biblical order of inheritance. That would be a second reason. A third reason, which isn't discussed that much, but it's important to know about, is the concern for leaving one's children too much. There is a precedent in the Talmud for concern for children who are inactive, or not just children, but people in general who are inactive. If they are not going to work because they've been covered by the estate, that may create problems for them. Further, we have a concern that we want people to be involved in yeshuvo shel olam, in the proper development of the world. They should be productive citizens. And again, if he's just sitting there spending his inheritance for the next number of decades, that would be inappropriate. If you take a look at source number 27, one brief line regarding the sage Reish Lakish, who tried to go through his entire estate before passing away. And Kinach Nafshe, when he died, Shavak Kava de Morika, he left behind a Kav. A Kav is a small volume of measure of Morika. Morika is saffron. Saffron is actually, I don't know if you saw the article online, the Wall Street Journal ran an article on saffron a couple of months ago as the most expensive product, like of any product in the world, my understanding. The most expensive product in the world per whatever measure you want to use to weigh it. More than gold, more than diamonds, more than oil. More than oil, a lot of things are. But saffron was very valuable in their day as well. And Reish Lakish leaves a unit of it, and Kara Anaf Sheva Zvula Cherim Chelam, and he quotes a biblical verse from Psalms, they left their strength to others. In other words, he's upset that he left even that behind to his heirs. He feels that that was actually wrong. I brought you another example, in source number 28. Amarle Rav L'Rav Hamnuna. Rav says to Rav Hamnuna, Bini, my son, Im Yesh Lecha, if you possess something, that's good for you. Shein b'shol tanug, because there is no pleasure in Sheol, in the grave. Ve'ein lamaves hismama, and death doesn't delay. Ve'im tomer aniach lebini, and if you'll say, well, let me leave it for my son. Chok b'shol miyagid lach, who's going to tell you what happened to it in Sheol? What do you care? He says to him. Which on the one hand, you say, like, what do you mean, what do you care? Like, aren't we supposed to be concerned for our children? Doesn't Judaism place a great emphasis, in fact, on concern for the next generations? And the answer is yes. Nonetheless, there's a tendency to say, leaving them something may not be good for them. Now, keep in mind that you're dealing with a very different economy in our day than you were dealing with 1700 years ago on a different continent in a world that operated very differently. I'm not suggesting this as proper estate planning. There are needs and things now that change the equation. But the important point that I do want to take from it is that we're not supposed to leave everything. That it's not an ideal of give them everything and have them be safe from having to work. That's not considered healthy. And then the last point within this segment is philanthropy. It's important to engage in philanthropy. Take a look at source number 29, a passage from the Talmud regarding the sage Mar Ukva. Kikanecha nafshe, when Mar Ukva was dying, Amar Aisuli Chushbanoi did tzedakah. He said, bring me my tzedakah account. He kept a ledger of how much money he had taken in and how much money he had given out philanthropically. He says, bring me the ledger. Ashkach tahava kasiv bei shivas alfei danri siyanki. And he found 7,000 dinari siyanki, a measure of currency, a large measure of currency, recorded there. And so he said, Zavdoi kalili v'orcha rechikta. He says, you know, my provisions are light and my path is long, meaning I'm going into the next world. I haven't acquired enough merit, he says. So come bizbize lepalge mamone. So he gets rid of half of it. He gives away half of his money. And then the Talmud asks, what do you mean? We have a tradition that a person is not supposed to give more than 20% to tzedakah, more than 20% of his assets. How do you give away 50? To which he answers, well, he was dying anyway. He wasn't going to use it. The point of not giving away more than 20% is because you don't want to fall on the community to be supported by them. That's no longer an issue for him. So he gave away 50%. The commentaries discuss this and ask why 50%. I saw a particularly interesting suggestion from the Aruch HaShulchan, Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein. He said, because a person is his own closest relative. That was what he said. He said, a person is his own closest relative. So therefore, he's giving 50% to himself. And that's the amount that he's giving away to charity. That he's giving away. And the other 50%, he'll distribute among the rest of the family. That was his explanation for how this worked. What we see here, in taking this together, is that when it comes to the disinheriting question, we do assign a certain honor to the Seder HaYerusha, the Torah's order of inheritance, but at the same time, we recognize that there are valid reasons for shifting, whether to avoid fights among the children, whether to help support children who need more support, whether to avoid giving them too much, or whether in order to satisfy philanthropic purposes within the community. And the last point, I really probably should have moved this a little bit earlier, but regarding the point of disinheriting, this was the quote I thought I had brought, source number 30. Amar le Shmuel Rav Yehuda. Shmuel, the sage, says to Rav Yehuda, he is in the middle of the 3rd century, he says, Shinana, sharp one, lo tehebe ba'avua yachsanta, don't be among those who divert inheritance, afilu mi brabisha lebratava, even from a bad son to a good one. Dela yedia maizara nafik mine. You don't know what's going to be in the end. How do you know how he's going to conduct himself? And how do you know how his children are going to conduct themselves? You think you're being wise, playing God and saying, well, this one deserves it and this one doesn't deserve it. He says, that's a very dangerous game and you don't know exactly how it's going to work out. So that in practice, halachic authorities tend to recommend that you make sure to leave at least something for each heir, even when you're entirely dissatisfied, entirely upset, and feel like what they're doing is inappropriate, you don't approve of their conduct, make sure that you leave something. And I brought you from Rabbi Feinstein in source number 31, who says, "Avshaladina ifsik kishmuel." As a matter of law, we follow Shmuel, who we saw in source number 30, who said, "Don't shift things." However, at the same time, we also find that the Tashbeit, Rabbi Shimon ben Samach Duran, writing in, I believe, the 14th century, he wrote that I'm just going to read you out of the English in the interest of time, he wrote that in early documents they noted that the deceased had left 4 zuz to his heirs. How much is 4 zuz? 2 goats, right? Right? Pesach night, Chag Gadya, right? You buy a goat for 2 zuz. So therefore, 4 zuz is 2 goats. So they would leave that. How much is a goat worth these days? In Ontario? The Canadian dollar sunk? I don't know. I don't know what goats run. But he says that their practice was to leave something to each of the heirs in order to satisfy this view within the sages. How much exactly is not clear, but they don't want to see people entirely disinherit. That's really the message. So what we've seen, to give the 30-second summary of what we said in the last hour and 20 minutes, is number one, that we value writing a will. That's something that is considered important despite concerns for ayin hara, you don't want to discuss death and so on. Nonetheless, people are supposed to write a will for the reasons that we discussed. The secular will is accepted by some authorities to just say that the law of the land guarantees that this will be carried out, and therefore that's equivalent of a kinyan, and therefore you don't need to go any further. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein and apparently Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik supporting this. In the event that one has children, though, who won't accept this, then you have a problem, and they may need a halachic will done. And so the question then is, what would one do? So we offered four different solutions. We offered giving the gift now with a retained life interest, or potentially calling this a trust, with a retained life interest in the property. We noted some of the challenges and problems with each of the four. I'm not going to go over them right now. The second approach was creating an artificial debt, which will be discharged if they distribute according to the instructions of the will. The third approach is the joint tenancy in the property. And then the fourth is the inter vivos trust, creating a living trust and depositing the assets there. The, in terms of distributions, generally Judaism frowns on disinheriting. Certainly those last sources that we know, it seemed pretty clear that we don't want to disinherit entirely, even where it's done for religious reasons. There is also a concern secularly that the government will not recognize disinheriting, and in fact will say that that may be, if they're viewed as an actual creditor, if the heirs are viewed as creditors, then it's, you may run afoul of the Fraudulent Conveyances Act. Even if they're not viewed as creditors, there's the public policy concern in which they will not uphold clauses in a will that disinherit for reasons that, that the government considers to be against public policy. Judaism does consider the Torah's order of inheritance as important, but recognizes that there may be justifications for violating it. I'm going to take questions now. For those who need to leave, you can just make sure, please, that you do sign in on the sheets that are around. Questions? Yes? Yeah. Yeah. Correct. That's correct. The firstborn principle of getting double is male. That is correct. Other questions? Okay. Thank you very much. I highly recommend the articles in the bibliography.